Our guest now is at the forefront of research on neurodiversity, deep diving into the brain to understand conditions such as ADHD, dyslexia and autism spectrum conditions, particularly in children. Karen Waldy is a professor at Auckland University School of Psychology and Centre for Brain Research and an associate investigator with the groundbreaking longitudinal Dunedin study growing up in New Zealand. Her research focuses on the underlying causes of neurodevelopmental differences and the links there can be to behavioural or mental health issues. Her work looks at genetic and environmental factors and uses pioneering neuroscanning methods to watch the brain at work. Karen Waldy is passionate about the need for teachers to know more about neurodiversity to better support children in the classroom. Kia ora, Karen.
Kia ora, how are you?
Really good, thanks. What led you first into this research and how long have you been doing it?
Well, I've started back in Canada, where I'm from, with an honours thesis with a supervisor that had a longitudinal study looking at how learning disabled children grew up. So that got me started, and then I went on to do a master's and a PhD, and I switched my focus a little bit to start trying to understand the brain and how it works and how it might not work in neurodiverse conditions such as ADHD, dyslexia, and autism. And I've been here for 20 years.
How do you describe to people the definition of neurodiversity, what it is, what it isn't?
Certainly. And it really is an umbrella term. It refers to variation in the brain's structure and function. And this can affect cognitive abilities such as language and reading, attention and self-control, and or social communication and interaction. And so we talk about it as an umbrella term, but it does include the neurodevelopmental conditions like dyslexia, dyspraxia, ADHD, autism, and so on. And it really is a way to distinguish these developmental conditions, those that you're born with, versus conditions that might be acquired through brain image injury or other sort of damage.
What are some of the brain scanning techniques you've been using?
Predominantly, we've been using fMRI, so functional magnetic resonance imaging, and we've got a current study based out of Gisborne Hospital, but we also use the scanner at the University of Auckland in the medical school there, but we also use EEG, and we have that in our School of Psychology. And that gives us a good idea of the timing of the events that are happening in the brain.
And so when you're scanning with people, what is it that you are doing or they are doing in order to observe brain activity?
Yeah, really good question, because our typical people are probably more aware of the typical MRI, which gives us just a picture of the structure of the brain. And then only a few scanners in New Zealand are functional. So that basically tracks the oxygenated blood as people are in the scanner performing mental tasks. So, for example, if I'm doing a study with people with dyslexia, I might have them do different language and reading tasks, and then I can see where in the brain is active and not active. And of course, we have neurotypical control individuals in there as well. And then if we're doing an ADHD study, like we're doing currently, we'll have a decision-making task that will try to concentrate on activity in the prefrontal cortex. And then we can see our individuals if they're activating certain areas there.
Are you seeing from that work quite or statistically significant results? How refined, how detailed are the scan results?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because it's important to note that we're not at the stage where we can use these techniques in sort of a personalized medicine manner. So we really do rely on lots of participants. So the current study, we're looking at having about 50 individuals in total, and that allows us statistically to see meaningful results. So even though we can see when I'm in the control room, I can see somebody's brain, I can see the activation as they're at rest or as they're doing their mental task. But yeah, it's nothing we can do to diagnose somebody just individually. It's with large groups of individuals. And it's a fabulous technique. And we've done lots of work, published lots of good articles.
So what are you learning then? Can you actually see differences between people with dyslexia, say, and people without? Are you getting statistically significant results again? And what can you see from those results?
Yeah, absolutely we can. So just a couple of examples. So with dyslexia, we've been able to show parts of the brain that should be active in neurotypical individuals when reading are not active in a dyslexic brain, particularly in what's called the superior temporal lobe in the left hemisphere. And it's a bit of the language network towards the back of the brain. So when we have people doing language tasks, they're scanned, we don't see as much activity there as there should be, whereas we see a lot of compensatory activities. So there's areas in the right hemisphere that are active, and we're able to correlate those areas with the with performance. And we're finding that these areas that are helping out are indeed helping dyslexics to read. So there's a lot of compensatory activity happening, which is really exciting. And then for a group like ADHD, we see different levels of different activation. So the prefrontal cortex is really important, and important area for all of us for planning and decision making and self-control and attention and short-term memory. And what we see when we have people with ADHD in the scanner performing a mental task that involves decisions, we see much, much less activity in the prefrontal cortex compared to the neurotypicals.
This idea of compensation in a different part of the brain seems to me to be very significant, because there is a very big difference between talking about difference and talking about deficit. And so often the focus has been on deficits, on a problem, on a disorder. Whereas, in fact, in many conditions, the abilities of the difference not been brought to the fore. In other words, what you are doing, perhaps, and what we are learning to understand is very, very important for everything from the education system to workplaces to just the way we talk and behave to many people's lives. What are your hopes for? What are your hopes for this?
Well, my hopes are better identification and diagnosis. I know a lot of parents are out there really concerned that in New Zealand we're not doing enough to identify and diagnose, because that's the first step before we can help with remediation and treatment if needed. And so there's always pros and cons to this sort of early identification. So as you mentioned, there's a risk of pathologizing people, the stigma of being labeled, because these aren't diseases. So we have to be careful with that. But on the other hand, knowledge is power. And knowing, what your child has or what you have or your partner has, it's a way of owning it. And it's a way of, being able to get more information. And there's so many good groups out there, local groups that offer support things like the ADHD Association, the Dyslexia Foundation, Autism New Zealand, Spelled New Zealand. You know, they're there to, you know, to help with identification and remediation. Because I do think that knowing your strengths and difficulties is really powerful. And once people can own it, then you will start hearing people say things like, you know, this is my superpower. They'll change it around.
Is the education system doing enough to understand and to support neurodiverse children? Is it still far too stuck in a one-size-fits-all approach, yeah, despite yeah. the efforts of teachers and others to change that?
Yeah, and I really want to just acknowledge there's a lot of great teachers out there really trying their best to help. But at a deeper level, so I'm not an educationalist, I'm a neuropsychologist by training, but coming into New Zealand, I was told that we don't have dyslexia here. And it took till 2007 before we were able to convince the Ministry of Education to officially acknowledge dyslexia. So I think we're a little bit behind in that regard, looking at neurodiversity as something that we're born with, that is a difference in brain structure and function, and it needs specialized help. So yeah, we are a little bit behind insofar as teacher training. There's very few classes, I believe, that are aimed at the neurodiverse individual and how best to help them.
What do we know now about genetic and environmental factors around neurodiversity? Is that becoming clearer?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think we start off by acknowledging that these are all polygenic disorders. So there's not just one gene at all. These are very, very complex conditions that involve numerous genes. So there's lots and lots of work looking at how genes and environments work together. And I think that's the best work currently done. I've got a Marsden grant currently looking at genetics with our growing up in New Zealand cohort. And yeah, you can't just look at the genes and you can't just look at the environmental risks. They really do work together. And we certainly are identifying a lot of early risks. I'm interested in what happens during pregnancy, how things like maternal depression and stress and problems of that nature can actually impact on offspring down the line. So there's a lot of rich work going on in genetics. And I think that really the combination of genetics and brain imaging techniques is the future of this field.
How far along do you feel you are in this work, using the brain scans to identify activity and, as we said, over a cohort of people, not an individual, but over a cohort of people to be able to see statistically significant differences, including the compensatory actions of parts of the brain? Here we are calling it compensatory. It's simply a brain doing things differently, right? But we perceive it to compensate for what's not happening in another part of the brain. How far are you along, do you think, in learning what it's going to be possible to learn?
Well, I think we're certainly not in the infancy. So especially here in New Zealand, we've got a good solid 10 years of work that we've been doing internationally, probably about 20 years at least. So we do know a lot about the brain, the typical brain and the atypical brain. But of course, we don't know everything. And the technology is just getting better and better. So I think we just, you know, watch this space, especially with genetics, as I mentioned, with that combining the brain imaging and our genetics, our ability to look at, you know, the cost is come down allowing us to look at the whole, you know, human genome. It's I think in the next 5 years, we're going to be making some amazing discoveries. And I think knowledge about how our conditions coexist together is really important, because I learned pretty early in my career that you rarely have somebody walk into the lab with just ADHD or just autism, that they really do have coexisting or comorbid conditions, including mental health conditions. So things like depression and anxiety are really commonly associated with neurodiversity.
But again, do we know yet whether that association is causal or the result of, including the result of one's life experiences in, you know, as we said, an education system or in a society that doesn't know enough?
That's right. And we definitely don't know enough to talk about causation. But in addition to all the good techniques that we've got out now, being able to utilize all of the wonderful longitudinal studies in New Zealand. So you mentioned the Dunedin study that I was luckily enough to be involved in back during the age 26 assessment, and I'm still involved. I'm going to Dunedin next week to work on the data. The study members are aged 50. And then the Growing Up in New Zealand study. So based here in Auckland and the surrounding areas, we've got over 6,000 children who we've just assessed when they're age 12. And it's having that diversity and certainly the cultural diversity that's and tracking these individuals since their parents were pregnant with them. So that information is also really, really invaluable and really helps us with the wider picture of looking at things like causality and risk factors and what happens with individuals over time.
It occurs to me now with that cohort age 50 from the Dunedin study, is adult diagnosis or later life diagnosis becoming a thing?
It really is. And I think that any clinician will say that they've got waiting lists. And I think part of that is because their kids are getting diagnosed. And once they see what happens when their kids are diagnosed, they get help. Then they think, you know, these conditions are highly heritable. They really are. I mean, particularly autism, but also ADHD and dyslexia. And the parents will recognize a lot of the behaviors in their children in themselves. And often when we become adults and we're trying to organize our work, our family, and we realize that, you know, actually I could do with some help here, and they'll get diagnosed. And then that starts their path to identification and self-awareness and all the power that gives to you.
Although I think, as you alluded to earlier, far too hard to get a diagnosis for many, many, many people.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, we've got educational psychologists, we've got GPs, which I think is probably your first bet to go to your GP. We've got developmental pediatricians, we've got psychiatrists. But yeah, we need more. And I'd be very happy to be involved in trying to have some sort of a system where we make the diagnosis identification easier.
Karen, thank you. Karen Waldy, who is Professor at Auckland University School of Psychology and Centre for Brain Research, and an Associate Investigator with the groundbreaking longitudinal Dunedin study Growing Up in New Zealand.